Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle Rocklin, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hey there, welcome to the Dr. Nina Show here on LA Talk Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Nina Savelle Rocklin. I am a psychoanalyst specializing in food, weight, and body image issues, and I'm here to help you lose weight without dieting. Yes, without dieting. That means no more counting calories or carbs, no more thinking about food all the time. It really is possible to lose weight and gain health, all without ever going on another diet. If you'd like to join me today and ask me anything about food, weight, or body image, or anything else that pertains to you, because whatever's going on with food has to do with whatever's going on with you, give me a call. The number here at the studio is 818-602-4929. That's 818-602-4929. So I am going to start with a question from someone who wanted to be anonymous. Okay, so this is from Anonymous, somewhere on planet Earth. Anonymous wants to know if I can suggest any positive affirmations to help with weight loss. Positive affirmations to help with weight loss. So I'm going to let you in on a secret. Here's the thing about positive affirmations and positive thinking. Positive thinking often makes you feel worse, not better. And of course, when you feel bad, you're more likely to eat for comfort or distraction. So positive thinking can actually cause eating issues to get worse. Now, how is it? What the heck am I saying? Positive thinking makes you feel worse instead of more positive. Let me give you an example, and this is based on a true story. This is something that actually happened to my grandmother, Bette. So my grandmother, Bette, was married three times. Her first husband, my actual grandfather, died when my mom was like 16. And then later on, she got married to a new man named Roger. And about 6 weeks, this is starting so sad, it has a good ending, I promise you. About 6 weeks after Bette got married to Roger, they were crossing the street in Manhattan. A drunk driver ran a red light, hit them both in the crosswalk. Roger was instantly killed. Bette's spine was broken, and she was told she would never walk again. Now, Bette proved the doctors wrong. She worked hard, and she did a lot of physical therapy for a lot of months, and she walked out of that hospital on crutches. She actually walked. It was a miracle. Nobody could believe that she had, A, survived this accident, and B, that she was able to walk again. And during the next weeks, well-meaning friends urged her to stay positive. They would say things like, "You're lucky to be alive. Focus on your new life. Don't think about the past. Focus on the good, not the bad. Stay positive," right? All of this positive thinking. And I remember my grandmother told me that a friend had come over for coffee, and her friend was like, "Oh my God, it is wonderful, Bette, to see you up and around. It's a miracle." And she's supposed to be happy. Like, there's this miracle happened. She was walking. And my grandmother said she was just eating coffee cake and eating coffee cake. She couldn't stop eating coffee cake. And finally, she put down her fork and she said to her friend, bursting into tears, she said, I can't stay positive. I can't stop thinking about Roger. We were newlyweds. He's gone. And the friend said, no lie, the friend actually said, "Look on the bright side. It could have been worse. We could have lost you too." So the friend is trying to be positive, urging her to stay positive. And Bette said she was positive. She was positive that she missed her husband. My grandmother had a sense of humor. Okay, so what does all of this have to do with your relationship to food? If you dismiss your true thoughts, emotions, and reactions, in favor of looking on the bright side, you're pushing away your truth. You're pushing away what you're feeling. You're pushing away what needs your attention. You know, if something bad happens, there may be a silver lining, and I encourage everyone to look for the silver lining, but not only focus on that silver lining, hold both. Something bad happens and something good can come out of it, but the good does not nullify or neutralize the bad. And if you don't deal with the bad, you're going to comfort yourself with food. You're going to distract yourself with food. You're going to turn emotional pain into physical pain by eating so much you're in pain. It's so much better if you just say, oh, this feels bad, rather than I shouldn't feel bad. I should be positive. So forget trying to stay positive when things are tough. The only way to get past the challenges and the losses of life is to deal with the bad stuff. You can't positive think away the bad stuff. You can't drop it. You can't ignore it. You can't stuff it down. The only way to get rid of bad feelings, which unfortunately bad feelings are a part of being human, the only way to get rid of them is to feel them, express them, process them, and work them through. So my grandmother did exactly that. She cried, and then she got mad. She felt her grief. She went through all the stages of grief, right? The stages of loss, according to Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance. And you got to go through all of those feelings before you get to acceptance. And that's how she was finally able, after some time, you know, to get past the pain and say, you know what, I do miss Roger, and I'm glad to be alive. I'm glad to be walking, literally walking. She had to hold both. So instead of positive thinking, which can be very dismissive, think realistically. So, for example, here's something that someone told me once. She was like, you know, I've gained 20 pounds. I've been emotionally eating. She said she's gained 20 pounds, but she said that she shouldn't be worrying about such trivial things because people are starving in Africa. People are dying in wars. You know, she has no right to be upset. She said she needs to be more positive and less focused on this 20 pounds. Now, okay, you know, on the outset, yeah, you know what? True, but how does that help you? So it doesn't help you. So instead, I encouraged her to think along the lines of, yes, she's gained 20 pounds, and she feels powerless and out of control. And it's really painful and upsetting when her clothes are tighter than they normally are. And so the solution is to say, yeah, you know what, this is upsetting. I'm going to pay more attention to why I'm eating. I'm going to pay attention to what's eating at me so I can reverse this weight gain trend. But in the meantime, it is very challenging, right? So acknowledging, validating that something is going on that's upsetting. You know, yes, people in Africa are starving or dying of AIDS, or people are dying in war, and all kinds of horrible things are happening in the world that's very tragic. But their pain does not minimize yours. If you are going through something, it needs your attention, not your condemnation. You know, if you break your arm, that hurts, right? I broke my arm at midnight on Halloween in the dorms, but that's a whole other story. I broke my arm, and it hurt. Now, if someone else broke both their legs in a skiing accident, that wouldn't have made my arm hurt less. Yes, they had worse pain. They broke their legs. But my arm still hurt. If you have a painful experience in your life, the fact that someone else's pain is worse does not make your pain not matter. I think that's too many negatives, but I think you guys get the idea of what I mean. You know, again, your pain needs your attention. Pain, anger, whatever is bothering you needs your attention, not your condemnation. So what to do? Validate and acknowledge what's going on. yes, this is what's happening. In the case of the woman who gained 20 pounds, I've gained 20 pounds. Of course, that's upsetting to me. That's troubling. You know, acknowledge it. Yes. Who wouldn't be upset if they just, you know, started eating uncontrollably and gained 20 pounds in a short period of time and none of their clothes were fitting and people were looking at them at work like, ooh, she's gained 20 pounds. That doesn't feel good. And then comfort yourself with words. Reassure yourself. There's something going on. I'm going to get to the bottom of it. I'm going to feel better one day, but this is hard. What can I do for myself that can give me comfort that doesn't have to do with food? When you acknowledge what you truly think and feel, even if it's painful, even if it's upsetting, you can deal with it and heal. But when you ignore it by staying positive, quote unquote, yes, when you stay positive, you're ignoring something that's going on with you. And if you ignore what's going on with you, it will continue to eat at you. And yes, I use that expression purposefully. Of that, I am positive. That's the only kind of positive thinking we want. Be positive that if you don't pay attention to what's going on with you, nothing is going to change. So that is my answer to Anonymous and to all of you about why positive thinking is not the way to go when it comes to weight loss or anything else that's going on in your life. If you would like to speak with me, my number is 818-602-4929. Again, 818-602-4929. Give me a call and tell me what's going on in your life. Okay. Now, I had someone post this on my Facebook page the other day. She's, as you guys might know, I have a 30-day online program called Kick the Diet Habit, and I started doing a 30-day challenge so that everyone who bought the program can do it together. And if you missed it this month, I'll be doing it again this summer. But so one of the people who is in the program wrote and said that she had a question. She said, how do I jam a stick in the gears or interrupt the connection between my feelings and using the food response that's so deeply entrenched and ingrained? So she gave an example. She said it was just Super Bowl. A friend was hosting a game night for at her house, and without thinking about it, because she asked, when this person was invited, she automatically said, yes, I'll come. Now, she's not a huge football fan. She is not a fan of getting into a cold vehicle to drive to a dark place she hasn't been before. And so already before the game night, she started getting a headache. She wasn't feeling good. She got more and more stressed about having committed to this. She didn't want to go, but she also didn't want to bail. She didn't want to disappoint her friend. And staying home, which is what she did not end up being restful or enjoyable, so she ended up feeling bad and eating. So then she was feeling all of this. Now think about everything she was feeling, sort of resentful, stressed, worried about being disappointing her friends. All of this was going on. So then she started eating pita chips. And then her husband said he was hungry, and she ran, and she capitalized it. I ran to get each of us a bowl of chips. I ate mine and finished off what he left behind. And then it just kind of went downhill from there. And she just said, she just kept eating. And she was understanding sort of in the moment and afterwards why she was turning to chips. She was angry. She was angry at herself. She was upset. She had all of these feelings churning. And she sort of displaced them onto chips. She used chips to distract herself and comfort herself in a way. She knew why she was doing it, but she still couldn't stop. So she said, my hindsight is 20/20. That's progress. But how do I step ahead of those chips when the event is in progress? I said she did ask herself if she was angry as she was eating chips, but it didn't matter. She still ate them. So I think that this is a question that a lot of people have, and I wanted to answer it for you guys because you might be having a similar question. You may, now that if you've been listening for a while or you know some of, or, you know, the way that I help you think about why you're turning to food, what's eating at you. Again, chips and anything crunchy is associated with anger. Smooth and creamy is associated with a need for comfort. Filling and bulky, you know, bread, pizza, pasta, anything that kind of takes up space, that's associated with filling a void, with loneliness. So a lot of people realize, oh, I'm eating this, so I must need comfort or I must be angry. Lots of people combine them. It's like, I can't have ice cream without nuts in it. So that's a combination of needing comfort and expressing some kind of edginess, some kind of anger. So they say, oh, I get it. I get why I'm doing it, but I can't stop. So here's the thing. This is not a switch that you turn on and off. You don't just one day go, oh, I have the insight of why I am turning to chips, so I will not do it. I wish it worked that way. That would be so much easier, but we're humans. We're messy. We're not switches. We're not robots. We are always involved in a process. So change is a process. And when it comes to changing your food, it goes like this. Up, hold that thought. I have a caller. Hi, caller. Welcome. It's Dr. Nina. Who's this?
Hi, Dr. Nina. This is Larry from beautiful downtown Burbank. How are you doing?
Hi, Larry from Burbank. How are you?
Good. I had a question. I know that my own urge to eat food comes from past incidents of, you know, abuse and nothing that outwardly visible as far as being major, however, and I'm wondering how it is that some people can go through horrific abuse, like getting thrown downstairs as kids or, you know, cigarettes put out on their forehead by mom and all that, and they can turn around and be entrepreneurs and, you know, captains of industry and, you know, high-level pro athletes and all that, while others have, like, emotional abuse or something that, from an outside observer at least, looks like a relatively little or nothing, and they wind up being partly paralyzed and dealing with stuff like this and eating 10 Twinkies for dinner. It just doesn't seem to make sense.
That is a great question, Larry, and part of my answer is that you don't really know what goes on behind closed doors of captains of industry. I don't know Oprah, but I do know that she is very public about her battles with weight, and I do know she has a fairly horrific background of abuse. So one could make the case that although Oprah has incredible success, obviously something unresolved is still affecting her relationship to food. So what looks like success on the outside, there may be some hidden things going on that we don't know about. But I want to make, you brought up a really good point, which is, how do we talk about trauma and how do we understand trauma? And there are two types of trauma. One is a big, significant event. I'm going to compare it to, like, you know, a stab wound to your stomach with a cleaver, right? Just one horrible event that is just demonstrably awful, horrific, traumatic, and terrible. That is one kind of trauma. The other kind of trauma are repetitions of what seem like less traumatic events, but the cumulative effect of them is equally as traumatic. So if we put that in sort of physical pain terms, it would be 1,000 small cuts. It is akin to one stab wound in the stomach. And so that, I think that's the difference. It's still trauma. It just looks different. One small cut is nothing. But if someone cuts you 1,000 times, you're going to be in agony, the same agony as if someone stabs you in the stomach. So that's why.
Yeah. It kind of reminds me of that saying, sticks and stones may break your bones, but words can kill you.
Yeah, I like your rendition better, because words certainly, you know, sticks and stone, what's the original, can break my bones, but words can never hurt me. Actually, words can hurt more than sticks and stones. Your bones can heal. You know, and also when people are brutalized by other people, and it's very visible, you know, these, like recently we had the horrible case of the 13 kids that were found in that home, you know, chained to their beds, and just the most awful, 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 awful abuse. Like people see it, people can respond to it, people can attend to it. When a kid goes to school and they're bruised up, authorities get involved. People intervene. Or you know, when you have something that's visible, people can help you. When you have wounds that are invisible, which are the wounds to your soul, to your mind, your spirit, then people don't see it. And another reason why some people are able to overcome their circumstances just has to do with resilience. You know, but I almost hesitate to say that, because more than resilience, sometimes there's just like people can't continue in their lives unless they resolve something. Some people have to resolve the unresolved, and then they can't, so they get stuck in that place.
Well, you know, I've been told actually by another therapist many moons ago that, you know, I'm reluctant to use the term, you know, to tell anyone I was emotionally abused. It sounds like, you know, cry me a river, go suck your thumb. But at least if my dad, let's say, had beaten me, and I survived, and that he'd beaten me, and I survived, and I grew up, I could handle it. I went through it. I actually processed it at that time. I may beat the hell out of him, but that's part of the process, quite frankly. In my case, this therapist said that it was like a hammer over my head that never dropped. Mm-hmm. So that hypervigilance was sort of the sauce added to the thousand tiny cuts.
Yes, and why did you have such a contemptuous reaction to the idea of emotional abuse?
It just sounds, you know, it sounds like, I guess I'm projecting what many people would think, which is, you know, being a mind reader, but it sounds like something that people need to get over. In fact, there was a rocker, a former Eagle, had a song that was a hit called Get Over It. You know, he wants to take your inner child and kick his little ass. That was one of the lyrics. And I think that's a prevailing opinion among the happily ignorant.
Yeah, those are probably the same people who believe in positive thinking. Just let it go. It's in the past. It's not in the past.
Right.
You know, my whole point is that we want to put the past in the past. The past is haunting the present. And I might speculate that when you say, oh, you know, get over it, with some contempt, maybe that's an identification with someone who wasn't very interested in what you were feeling, just wanted you to get over it, and so you've kind of identified with that attitude towards you.
Mm-hmm. That fear could come from the part of me that believes it.
And identified with whoever told you that. And I should make a point that I don't believe in blame, right? Blame is, I was emotionally abused, and that's why it's all their fault, and that's why I'm this way. Wah. You know, that, notice my own contemptuous way of saying that. That's not what it's about. That keeps you stuck. What good is that? If you just point a finger and go, it's their fault. You know, my poor inner child, it's their fault. That doesn't help anybody. But if you think about it in terms of explaining, so explaining is, this is what happened to me, this is how it affected me, and this is how I've continued to relate to myself in the same way now, to my detriment, and I need to understand that and work through the original relational issues so that I free myself from that you can get somewhere.
To understand compassionate cause and effect versus you did this to me. And that's been not a speed bump, but a pretty high hurdle. And I'm wondering off the top of your head if you know of any books, whatever, that can specifically explain how to get past blame into cause and effect. Because, like I say, it's been, I think, part of that, you know, it's been a big thing, come to think of it.
I don't off the top of my head, but this is one of the things that I talk about, like, in my online program, is I help people identify, well, in your relationship to yourself, what from the past is continuing to be enacted. So, for example, if you have a, and this is what I talk about all the time, and I'm writing a book. Someone just posted on Instagram, we're waiting for your new book. I'm like, I'm writing as fast as I can, and I'm going to talk about this. So if you have a judgmental father, and growing up, there's a relationship between you, Larry, and your judgmental father. Then you grow up, that father may be gone, maybe out of your life, maybe passed away. But what was relational between you and your father, you and another person, now becomes a relationship between different parts of you.
Mm-hmm.
So that you are, you know, there's a, in my office, I have like a saying. It's sometimes I open my mouth and my mother comes out. It's
good.
A quote. Yeah. Well, father too. So you want to recognize what's you and what's learned from them.
Right.
And this works.
And just separate the two.
And this works both ways. I think I've talked about this actor that I know of who was raised by extremely supportive, loving parents. And by his own admission, he is not the best actor in the world, but he literally gets every audition he goes for. And he doesn't understand why people get nervous in auditions. He'll be like, of course they're going to love me. You know, of course. So he walks into a room like, hey, how are you doing? Like, with this expectation of that they're just going to love him because his parents loved him. So he's lovable, as opposed to people who walk in expecting to be judged or criticized or, you know, made to, they re-experience something from the past in that audition. So the way that we're taught to the way that we're related to becomes the way we relate to ourselves, and it becomes the way we expect people to relate to us. The more that you can heal the original wound, and remember, if people are unsafe, food becomes the substitute. The more that you can heal the original relationship, the less you're going to perpetuate it.
Right. As you were talking, I was thinking that if someone is given perfect parenting, but it goes too far, and they wind up thinking they're the king of the world. You know, some of them wind up in the Oval Office, so it can go too far.
It can go too far. But there's a difference between gratifying and spoiling your child rotten not imposing limits and giving them a really healthy sense of self.
Right, exactly. And to be honest, and I don't know, my brother doesn't listen to this show, that's what he and his wife did with their kids. And it's nice to see that, to see, you know, how it's done right. It really is good. Anyway, I'm not going to be calling next week. I made a note to share that I'm going to be out of town doing one of the things on my bucket list and that is to perform brain surgery on Valentine's Day. That's the teaser for the following week.
Well, I'm at a loss, as I'm sure other listeners are. But I hope that on next week, which is Valentine's Day, that the person that you're most loving to is yourself.
Yeah, that's good advice. Okay.
Because when you're kind to yourself and loving and supportive of yourself, you feel better. And when you feel better and feel good and can comfort yourself, support yourself with words, you don't need to use food to escape yourself, comfort, distract, or anything else. And
right. I whenever I'm feeling good and balanced, the sugar, the Twinkies, all the garbage loses its power completely.
Exactly. And when you have a good relationship with yourself, you're only going to accept good treatment from others. When you have a bad relationship to yourself and you're mean and critical to yourself, someone else who's mean and critical can feel like someone who really knows you, really knows you well.
And it's worth mentioning that that's part of my history, is people pick up on that very often through self-deprecating humor, so it's not unconscious. It's just my way of saying, you know, I am worth this and only this, and I'll share that with you before you figure it out. And then I'm shocked when they come back and put me down or whatever. So, yeah, indeed, that's true. That's very true.
So, what is it? Was it Oscar Wilde who said that to love oneself is the beginning of a lifelong great relationship? I'm totally butchering the quote, but it's something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Wise words.
That's the one that counts.
Yeah.
Well, I think you've said when the oxygen masks fall while the jet is flipping over, you know, grab your mask first. And that's true as well.
Yeah, you're no good. Well, hopefully the jet's not flipping over. Hopefully it's just a glitch and the oxygen masks drop and you have to put it on yourself, because you're no good to anybody else if you're giving all your oxygen away. You know, you have to take care of, self-care is key, and you can't be in the world unless you've set a standard of good treatment towards yourself. And remember, thoughts lead to feelings, lead to behavior. Too often people just look at the behavior without realizing that it comes from somewhere. So if you have a thought, I'm worthless, you're going to feel horrible, really crummy, and maybe turn to those Twinkies. But if you
go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Well, you know, if the thought is conscious, that's one thing. But if it's unconscious, that's even more damaging. But if I say, hey, I'm really, well, no, I'm not, I can challenge that. But it's like this bedrock that's much bigger below. If I say that thing, but I'm not aware of it, then I just take over and act accordingly, which is in the wrong direction.
And that's exactly why I developed the food mood formula, because it becomes so unconscious and automatic that people don't even realize they're being triggered. It's like with the woman who was asking me, well, what do I do, you know, when I know what's going on, but I still can't stop. You know, a lot of times you don't know what's going on, and that's why I think about the food mood formula, and then you can attend to that instead of thinking about the food part.
Okay. That's good. Makes sense. Okay. All right. I'm going to get back to my writing, so I'm good to go. Thank you very much.
Larry, thank you as always for your interesting, provocative, and never dull calls.
I'll mention the brain surgery in 2 weeks, and I appreciate your wisdom.
Okay. Happy Valentine's Day next week.
You too. Thanks.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
So interesting. Oh. No, I was just thinking about what Larry was saying. But I want to get back to what I was telling you guys about. Okay, you recognize that you're feeling a certain thing. And that's why you're eating chips. That's why you're eating ice cream. That's why you're, you know, eating cake, whatever it is. So the thing is, like, as I was saying, it's not a switch that you flip up and down. It's a process. And here's how the process usually goes. At first, you have no idea that anything is going on in your head or your heart. You think it's all about food. You think the problem is you have no willpower. You feel terrible about yourself. You think there's something wrong with you. You feel awful, 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 awful. So that's the first step of the process. Then you realize at some point after making unhealthy or emotionally based food choices, you realize later that you were triggered not by food, by situations, and you recognize what those triggers are. Oh, I was feeling this, and that's why I ate that. Then at some point, you realize in the moment why you're reaching for food, but you do it anyway. I know I'm angry. I know I'm doing. I'm angry. That's why I'm eating this. But I'm going to eat it anyway. Then the next step that people get to is you realize in the moment why you want to eat whatever it is that you want to eat or why you're eating it, and you're able to respond to yourself effectively with words. You're able to self-soothe, self-comfort, tolerate whatever anxiety or bad feeling it is, and you're so that you don't turn to food. So it's like, oh, I could go and eat. Oh, no. I know why I want to do that. No, I'm not going to do that. What's really going on with me? I need comfort. Okay, how can I comfort myself? Oh, I'm going to validate, acknowledge, and reassure myself, and I'm going to make myself feel better, or I'm going to do something for me. And then the last step in this process is you don't even have the urge to go to food. You don't even have the thought of going to food because you have gotten so good at self-soothing and self-responding with words that food eating, it is not even a thought in your mind. Now, you may be listening to this and thinking, that's a fairy tale. That's never going to happen. I can't imagine that in a million, trillion, billion years. Well, it really can happen. It really can. It just unfolds, and the more that you just keep at it and keep this new way of recognizing what's eating at you, finding new ways of relating and responding to yourself, you will see a huge miraculous change. I've seen it happen over and over to people who were like, yeah, maybe for other people, Dr. Nina, but that's not happening for me. Never. And then it happens for them. So, and I include myself because as you guys know, I have my own history of eating disorders. So I know what it's like to think there is no way that I can respond to myself in a different way or not think about what I've eaten or what I'm going to eat or not go to bed counting calories or not wake up and think, how am I going to be good today? You may think that is impossible, but I am here to tell you it is possible. You just have to keep taking those steps forward and you will get there. And, you know, speaking of steps forward, I meant to talk about this last month, right after Martin Luther King Day, but for some reason I didn't. So I'm doing it now. One of the things that Martin Luther King said was, you don't have to see the whole staircase. Just take the first step. I love Martin Luther King. Oh, such a genius. Of course, taking that first step is easier said than done because that staircase represents change. And sometimes we wait until we're ready to climb and we look up that staircase and we think we should just effortlessly bound up those stairs without losing a single step, without falling. We should just make it up to the top. But that's not how change happens. It is slow. Sometimes you just have to have blind faith. You fall, you stumble, you start up, you get halfway up the staircase and you fall back down. It's totally like that game of chutes and ladders, if you ever played that as a kid or play it with your kids. You get up and then you fall down. But eventually you reach the top. So it makes me think about one of my friends, who's author and Huffington Post blogger, Iris Ruth Pastor. She says, change is a result of mouse steps, not kangaroo steps, which is very cute and correct. So whatever steps you are taking, just remember, you are a step ahead than you were before. If you want things to be different, you have to do something differently. And then you have to just keep doing it. And it's easier to do the thing that is familiar, even if the thing that is familiar is bad for you. If it's more familiar to turn to ice cream or chips or whatever when you're upset, then that's your go-to because it's your most familiar thing. It takes a while to break that habitual response to anxiety or pain or upset of any kind. And so one of the things that you can do is just be curious, not critical. One of my favorite expressions, as people who know me can tell you, I love to say, be curious, not critical. Because if you're critical and you say, oh, why did I eat that? I can't believe I ate that. I'm never going to lose weight. I can't believe I ate those cookies. Then you're just going to feel bad. And of course, if you're going to feel bad, you may eat more cookies just to get away from your own mean voice. Or you may say, oh, I've already eaten this many cookies. I might as well eat the rest of the cookies. And you just stay in that horrible cycle. You know that cycle. I think you do. So that's being critical. It gets you nowhere. It keeps you in a loop of self-hatred and self-recrimination. And it's just, oh, it's hard. Curiosity, on the other hand, you can ask yourself the same question. Why did I eat those cookies? What was going on with me? What made me eat those cookies? From a non-judgmental, non-critical, interested perspective, you're more likely to find the answer. So if you ask yourself, if you take a few seconds to consider what's eating at you, even if you eat it anyway, you're making space for a new understanding. And each day, you can make that space bigger and bigger and bigger until one day you realize, you know what? Food isn't the problem. It's a temporary solution to that problem. And when you realize what the real problem is and take care of it and attend directly to it, then food stops being there for comfort or distraction. So that's why just, you know, baby steps is the way to go. Don't have to see the whole staircase. Just take the first step and the next and the next. And if you slide down to the bottom, you just have to pick yourself up and keep going. You will get to the top of that staircase. And it gets easier and easier to take those steps too. Okay. I have another question from Quinn, who says, I saw you speak a couple years ago at an event in Santa Monica. I remember you talking about little kids and cookies, and I was really inspired at the time, but now I can't remember what you said. Can you tell the story again? Oh, gee. Well, Quinn, I'm glad you remember part of it. By the way, that speech is on YouTube under hashtag Shake It for Self-Acceptance. It was at the Shake It for Self-Acceptance event in Santa Monica. And basically what I told people was I told them about something that had actually happened to me. Well, not to me, something I saw. So I was at the park. My kids were off playing, or, you know, one of my kids was there. Anyway, they were off playing with their friends. And so I was just sort of sitting there, and there were these two little girl and a little boy. These toddlers were playing in the sand, and they were digging and sifting and eating sand and just having a great time in the sand being toddlers. And all of a sudden, the boy got up and ran off, just took off with the shovel. And so, of course, the little girl burst into tears. Like, of course, she's upset. Her friend took off, and she's sad. And, I mean, who hasn't been there when, you know, you're with someone and all of a sudden they take off with a shovel without a word? I mean, we've all been there, right? It doesn't feel good. But here comes her mom running up going, don't cry, don't cry, don't cry, don't cry. It's okay. Like, totally panicked. And, of course, the girl kept crying because, you know, like I said, you're hanging out with someone, thinking everything is going fine, you're getting along, suddenly they're gone, you're upset. But mom starts digging in her diaper bag, and she's like, stop crying, it's okay, it's okay. And then she says, here, have a cookie. And she's holding out a cookie. So what did that little girl learn? She learned that feelings cause other people to be anxious and upset, and she should not cry. But if she absolutely could not stop herself, a cookie would do the trick. hello, binge eating disorder in the future, right? I mean, you can just see it coming. So, you know, here's the thing. Cookies don't take away feelings. You cannot stuff feelings down, nor can you starve them away or drink them away or gamble them away or work them away or let them go or, as I talked about earlier, use positive thinking to get rid of them. There's only one way to get rid of feelings. If her mother had just said, yeah, honey, that hurts. It's hard when people leave you and take your stuff. That's painful. Of course you're crying. If she had said that, that little girl would have had a good cry, and then she would have felt better. And she would have learned, okay, you know what? I have a right to my feelings. I felt this certain way. It was a reaction to the situation. I felt it. Now I feel better. That's how I get rid of feelings. And so we really need to accept that feelings are reactions to situations and not character flaws. You know, in this country, we have a problem because we make emotions into bad, scary things. You're considered weak if you feel your feelings and strong if you don't. Now, how does that even make sense? Doesn't it take a lot of strength to deal with something painful and difficult? So keep in mind, if you get mad, you are not an angry person. You're a person who's angry. If you get sad, you're a person who's sad, not a depressed person, unless you are depressed, which is a totally different thing. These are just reactions to situations that I'm talking about. So ultimately, we have to accept that everything we feel today and every day is that emotions are not a sign that you are weak. They are a sign that you are human. And by accepting your feelings, you accept your humanity. And that's really the healthiest outlook that you can have, right? Because when you accept your feelings and you respond to them, then you don't use food as a replacement. So, you know, think about, let's see what time. I have a couple more minutes, just a couple more minutes. I just want to say something about hunger. Of course, hunger is the physiological need for food. But we also use the word hunger to express any feeling of yearning. So, you know, you could have a hunger for something emotionally, intellectually, creatively, spiritually, and more fulfilling. You can hunger for, you know, a sense of trust and safety. No, unconditionally. You don't have to be perfect to be loved. You can hunger for feeling appreciated for your quirks instead of apologizing for them. You can hunger for a really strong connection with someone else. You can hunger for deep and meaningful conversations. You can hunger for a child. You get the idea. So, you know, think about what you are hungry for in life. Remember that binging or overeating is not an addiction. It's nothing to do with willpower. It is a coping strategy that helps you deal with painful, upsetting emotions and conflicts. And when you can crack the code, figure out what is eating at you, what you're hungry for, and attend to those things directly, then food stops being the solution to the problem, and lunch becomes lunch, dinner becomes dinner, cookies become cookies, not a battlefield. And that is something that's just so important to keep in mind, that if you have a problem with food, as many people say, you've got to remember you don't have a problem with food. You have a problem, and food is the solution to that problem. But when you identify what the true problem is and you respond accordingly, then you don't need food as a solution. And that's how you make peace with food. That's how you win the diet war. That's how you kick the diet habit. And that's how you sweeten your life. That's how you feel better in your life. And that's what this is all about, right? So thank you so much for joining me here today on LA Talk Radio. I am here on the Dr. Nina Show every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Pacific. And you can listen live, again, 10 a.m. Pacific here on LA Talk Radio, or you can listen on iTunes on the Dr. Nina Show on LA Talk Radio. If you do a search, you'll find it. And if you like the show, please don't forget to leave either a review or a rating, because the more ratings that we get, the more people we reach, the more people I can help, and that's a beautiful thing. So you can do your part by leaving me a review and or a rating. Thank you so much. I will see you next week.
You're listening to The Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle-Rocklin, only on LA Talk Radio.